Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to another edition of the 411 Talk Zone Radio Show. My name is Leon Jones. This evening, I'm going to talk about redlining and how it destroyed cities via systemic racism. This podcast is going to be a series of talking about how cities become blighted. They go into decay. But before I move on with the topic, let me get a list of housekeeping items. First of all, I'd like you to like, share, and subscribe to the 411 Talk Zone Radio Show on YouTube, because I'm giving you quality information for educational purposes from a professional, mature perspective. All the topics that I do on Blog Talk Radio and YouTube are 100% realistic and they're positive. So on that note, let me jump into the topic. Now, we're going to focus on one aspect of urban decay. And I'm going to talk about redlining. But first, you must understand what causes urban decay in every city and where most of these cities are located. And who occupies most of these cities? First of all, when I talk about urban decay, you have to define what urban decay is. I mean, we know how it occurs, but what is urban decay? You'll hear a lot of that when it comes to urban renewal, cities, nonetheless. Basically, urban decay, or some people call it urban rot or urban blight, is a process by which a previously functioning city or part of a city falls into despair and decrepitude. Now, it may feature deindustrialization, depopulation, deurbanization, structuring. Of course, there's abandoned buildings and infrastructure, high local unemployment, fragmented families, political disenfranchisement, crime, and a desolate cityscape that's also known as gray field or urban prairie. Now, when we talk about planning, one must understand that urban planning can be part of urban decay. And when I say urban planning, the urban planning can be poor. Now, urban planning basically involves planning for land use and transportation. A city could propose to use land in poor ways so as to accelerate the urban decay. For example, when a major employer in a city decides to move outside the city would experience high rates of population decline because people would move with the employer. A city could have made the company stay by offering more appealing offers, but instead the moving of the company leaves more land unused and the buildings abandoned. Now, the big item I want to talk about within urban decay is redlining. Now, in the United States, Redlining is the systematic denial of various services to residents of specific, often racially associated neighborhoods or communities, either directly or through the selective raising of prices. While the best known examples of redlining have involved denial of financial services such as banking or insurance, other services such as healthcare or even supermarkets have been denied to residents. Now, in case of retail businesses like supermarkets, purposely locating and practically far away from said residents in a redlining effect, reverse redlining occurs, and that's when a lender or insurer, particular neighborhoods that are predominantly non-white, not to deny residents loans or insurance, but rather to charge them more than in a non-redlined neighborhood where there is more competition. Now, in the 1960s, sociologist John McKnight coined the term or the phrase redlining to describe the discriminatory practice of fencing off areas where banks wouldn't void investments based on community demographics. During the heyday of redlining, the areas most frequently discriminated against were basically black inner city neighborhoods. For example, in Atlanta in the 1980s, a Pulitzer Prize winning series of articles by investigative reporter Bill Deadman showed that the banks would often lend to lower income whites, but not to middle or upper class blacks. Now, the use of blacklists is a related mechanism also used by redliners to keep track of groups, areas, and people that the discriminating party feels should be denied business or aid or other transactions. In academic literature, redlining falls under the broader category of credit rationing. Now, redlining has different parts. And just as I mentioned grocery stores, when we go to the brick and mortar infrastructure, we talk about retail. Well, retail redlining is a spatially discriminatory practice amongst retailers. Taxicab services and delivery food may not serve certain areas based on their ethnic minority composition and assumptions about business and, of course, perceived crime. Rather than data and economic criteria, such as potential profitability in those operating areas, consequently, customers in these areas are vulnerable to prices set by fewer retailers. They may be exploited by retailers who charge higher prices and or offer them inferior goods. Now, when it comes to online, well, a 2012 study by the Wall Street Journal found that Staples, Home Depot, Rosetta Stone, and some other online retailers display different prices customers in different locations, distinct from shipping prices. Now, Staples based discounts on proximity to competitors like Office Max and Home Depot. This generally resulted in higher prices for customers in rural areas who were on average less wealthy than customers seeing lower prices. Now, in your urban ghettos, you also find what we call liquor lining. And how that occurs is some service providers target low-income neighborhoods for nuisance sales. When those services are believed to have adverse effects on a community, they may consider it to be a form of reverse redlining. Now, the term liquor lining is sometimes used to describe high densities of liquor sales in low-income and or minority communities relative to surrounding areas. Now, high densities of liquor stores are associated with crime and public health issues, which in turn may drive away supermarkets, grocery stores, and other retail outlets, contributing to low levels of economic deployment. Correction, that's low levels of economic development. Again, high densities of liquor stores are associated with crime and public health issues, which may in turn drive away supermarkets, grocery stores, and other retail outlets, contributing to low levels of economic development. Now, controlled income non-whites face higher concentrations of liquor stores than do whites. Now, in 2007, a class action lawsuit was brought against the student loan lending giant Sallie Mae in the United States District Court for the District of Connecticut. Class alleged that Sallie Mae discriminated against African Americans and Hispanic private student loan applicants. That's right. The class action suit alleged that Sallie Mae discriminated against African American and Hispanic private student loan applicants. Now, the case alleged that the factors Sallie Mae used to underwrite private student loans caused a disparate impact on students attending schools with minority populations. Now, the suit also alleged that Sallie Mae failed to properly disclose loan terms to provide student loans. And again, the borrowers of these private student loans were Hispanics and minorities, which were African American. Now, the lawsuit was settled in 2011. The terms of the settlement included Sallie Mae agreeing to make a $500,000 donation to the United Negro College Fund and the attorneys for the plaintiffs receiving $1.8 million in attorney's fees. Now, when you look at redlining, there's also credit card redlining. Now, credit card redlining is a spatially discriminatory practice among credit card issuers of providing different amounts of credit to different areas based on their ethnic minority composition rather than on economic data, such as the potential profitability of operating in these areas. Scholars assess certain policies, such as credit card issuers reducing credit lines of individuals with a record of purchases at retailers frequented by so-called high-risk customers, to be akin to redlining. Now, in 2003, Gregory D. Squires wrote that data showed that race continues to affect the policies and practices of the insurance industry. Racial profiling or redlining has a long history in the property insurance industry in the United States. From a review of industry underwriting and marketing materials, court documents, and research by government agencies, industry and community groups, and academics, it is clear that race has long affected and continues to affect the policies and practices of the insurance industry. Home insurance agents may try to assess the ethnicity of a political, or let's utilize the word potential. So they will call the customer by telephone, which would affect what services they offer. And once they understand the offer of the services, and I'm talking about the particular ethnicity, well, they're going to get inquiries about purchasing a home insurance policy. Now, this type of discrimination is known as linguistic profiling. Now, again, linguistic profiling is the practice of identifying the social characteristics of an individual based on auditory cues, in particular, dialect and accent. Now, this theory was first developed by Professor John Ball to explain discriminatory practices in the housing market based on auditory redlining. There have also been concerns about redlining in the automotive insurance industry. Reviews of insurance scores based on credit are shown to have unequal results by ethnic group. The Ohio Department of Insurance in the early 21st century allows insurance providers to use maps and collection of demographic data by zip code in determining insurance rates. The FHEO Director of Investigations at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Sarah Pratt, wrote, "Like other forms of discrimination, the history of insurance redlining began in conscious, overt racial discrimination practiced openly and with significant community support in communities throughout the country. There was documented overt discrimination in practices relating to residential housing, from the appraisal manuals, which established an articulated policy of preferences based on race, religion, and national origin, to lending practices, which only made loans available in certain parts of town or to certain borrowers, to the decision-making process in loans and insurance, which allowed the insertion of discriminatory assessments into final decisions about either." Now, when it comes to mortgages, reverse redlining occurs when a lender or insurer particularly targets minority consumers, not to deny them loans or insurance, but to charge them more than would be charged to a similarly situated white consumer, specifically marketing the most expensive and onerous loan products. Now, these communities had largely been ignored by most lenders just a couple of decades earlier. Now, in the 2000s, some financial institutions considered black communities as suitable for prime, subprime mortgages. Wells Fargo partnered with black churches in black communities, where the pastor would deliver seminars in their sermons and the bank would make a donation to the church in return for every new mortgage application. Working class blacks wanted a part of the nation's home-owning trend. Instead of contributing to home ownership and community progress, predatory lending practices through reverse redlining stripped the equity homeowners struggled to build and drain the wealth of those communities for the enrichment of financial firms. The growth of subprime lending, which subprime loans are basically higher costs to loan borrowers with flaws on their credit records or their credit report. Now, prior to the 2008 financial crisis, coupled with the growing law enforcement activity in those areas, clearly showed a surge in a range of manipulative practices. Not all subprime loans were predatory, but virtually all predatory loans were subprime. Some subprime loans certainly benefit high-risk borrowers who would not qualify for conventional prime loans. Now, predatory loans, however, charge unreasonably high rates and fees by compared to the risk trapping homeowners in unaffordable debt and often costing them their homes and their life savings. Now, a survey of two districts of similar incomes, one largely white and the other largely black, found the bank branches in a black community offered largely subprime loans and almost no prime loans. Studies found that high-income blacks were almost twice as likely to end up with subprime home purchase mortgages as did low-income whites. Some loan officers referred to blacks as bud people and to subprime lending as ghetto loans. A lower savings rate and a distrust of banks stemming from a legacy of redlining may help explain why there are fewer branches in minority neighborhoods. In the early 21st century, brokers and telemarketers actively pushed subprime mortgages. A majority of the loans were refinance transactions, allowing homeowners to take cash out of their appreciating property, or pay off credit card and other debt. Redlining has helped preserve segregated living patterns for blacks and whites in the United States, as discrimination is often contingent on the racial composition of neighborhoods and the race of the applicant. Lending institutions such as Wells Fargo have been shown to treat black mortgage applicants differently when they are buying homes in white neighborhoods than when buying homes in black neighborhoods. Dan Immergluck writes that in 2002, small businesses in black neighborhoods receive fewer loans even after accounting for business density, business size, industrial mix, neighborhood income, and the credit quality of local businesses. Now, several state attorneys have begun investigating these practices, which may violate fair lending laws. And when I talk about attorneys, I am talking about state attorney generals. Now, during this redlining, the NAACP filed a class action suit charging systemic racial discrimination by more than a dozen banks. Now, policies related to redlining and urban decay can often act as a form of environmental racism, which in turn affect public health. Urban minority communities may face environmental racism in the form of parks that are smaller, less accessible, and of poorer quality than those in more affluent or white areas in some cities. This may have an indirect effect on health, since young people have fewer places to play and adults have fewer opportunities for exercise. Robert Wallace writes that the pattern of the AIDS outbreak during the 80s was affected by the outcomes of a program of planned shrinkage. Now, planned shrinkage is basically municipal disinvestment. It's a term in the United States which describes an urban planning process in which that a city or town or other municipal entity decides to abandon or neglect an unproductive zone. It can happen when the municipality is in a period of economic prosperity and it seeks to improve. Now, planned shrinkage is basically directed at African American and Hispanic communities. It was implemented through systemic denial of municipal services, particularly fire protection resources, essential to maintain urban levels of population density and ensure community stability. Institutionalized racism affects general health care as well as the quality of AIDS health intervention and services in minority communities. The overrepresentation of minorities in various disease categories, including AIDS, is partially related to environmental racism. The national response to the AIDS epidemic in minority communities was slow during the 80s and 90s, showing an insensitivity to ethnic diversity in prevention efforts and AIDS health services. Now, workers living in American inner cities have more difficulty finding jobs than do suburban workers. Why? Well, you have to understand that black folk, they basically had no transportation. Now, when you combat redlining, this is where you had the Fair Housing Act. The Fair Housing Act, also known as the Civil Rights Act of 1968, was passed in order to help protect minority individuals from the discriminatory practices of financial institutions and agents. The Human Relations Commission of Pennsylvania adopted guidelines regarding redlining. The guidelines demonstrate practices that are to be prohibited in the selling property of people. Again, redlining is basically a form, I call it systemic racism. Now, part of redlining is when you have rent control. Let me make a correction on that. Redlining deals with retail, credit, insurance, also the Federal Highway Administration, any type of means to keep services from being in minority areas. But rent controls are often enacted due to public pressure and complaint regarding the cost of living. Proponents of rent controls argue that rent controls combat inflation but stabilize the economic characteristics of a city's population. They also prevent rent gouging and improve the quality of housing. It has been documented that rent control distorts the supply and demand relationship in housing markets, which contributes to the rapid deterioration of the community and to urban blight, and it does not provide the supposed benefits its proponents promise. Now, rent control contributes to urban blight by reducing new construction and investment in housing and de-incentivizing maintenance. If a landlord's cost to perform maintenance consume too large a proportion of revenue from rent, the landlord will feel pressure to drastically reduce or eliminate maintenance entirely. This effect has been observed in New York City, as 29% of rent-controlled buildings were categorized as either deteriorated or dilapidated, in contrast with 8% of non-controlled housing. You know, like I said, redlining causes a lot of problems. Redlining comes from discrimination. This is racial discrimination. This is why you have modern ruins. And it's going to continue to hurt our cities. Now, our cities had a lot of deindustrialization as well, and that really caused cities such as Gary, Midland, Pennsylvania, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Benton Harbor, Michigan, Flint, Michigan. Now, deindustrialization is basically a process of social and economic change caused by the removal of capacity or activity in a country or region heavily, and when I say heavy industry, or manufacturing industry, that is basically the opposite of industrialization. Let me go with a review of what I just said so you'll understand this. When you have deindustrialization, basically you have a process of social and economic change that's basically caused by the removal or reduction of industrial capacity or activity in a country or region, especially one that had heavy industry or manufacturing. Now, it is the opposite of industrialization, which is the period of social and economic change that transforms a human group from an agrarian society into a social or an industrial society. Again, industrialization is the period of social and economic change that transforms a human group from an agrarian society into an industrial society, and that involves the extensive reorganization of an economy for the purpose of manufacturing. And that's what you had here in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Maryland, West Virginia, Illinois, Michigan, but overall, when it comes to redlining, one must understand that redlining occurs when services such as banking, insurance, and access to jobs and health care are denied to certain races or classes of people through increasing the costs. Now, the term was coined in the late 1960s to refer to targeting of certain areas of Chicago where banks would not invest due to racial discrimination. Now, as a result, of course, these areas would remain underdeveloped as no one was willing or able to invest there. So the lack of investment increases the levels of unemployment and poverty, which in turn contributes to urban decay. And also racial discrimination, which ties into redlining, contributes to urban decay by providing for higher rates of unemployment, as African Americans were most likely to be declined jobs or loans, both of which would help their economic status as well as the health of their neighborhoods. Discrimination thus promotes unemployment, which in turn promotes poverty, street gangs, and illegal drug trafficking activities and other crimes. Discrimination also stifles opportunities which would normally be available to certain races, and in turn stifles the growth of a city. That's right, discrimination stifles opportunities which would normally be available to certain races, and in turn stifles the growth of a city by promoting urban decay. Now, if you go around to a number of these cities that I just mentioned, Gary, Indiana, Benton Harbor, Michigan, Flint, Michigan, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Youngstown, Ohio, East Liverpool, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, Joliet, Illinois. Now, these are some of the small cities. These are the areas that are along the Rust Belt, and this is where they had a lot of the manufacturing of cars. Now, I live here in Portage, Indiana, and there is still here, but it's not as big as it was in the 50s. But I want everybody to understand that when it comes to what you see in the cities, I mentioned liquor lining, I mentioned credit lining, retail lining, all of these substances fit right into discrimination. And of course, once again, you must understand that redlining is the systemic denial of various services to residents of specific, often racially associated neighborhoods or communities, either directly or through the selective raising of prices. When you understand that redlining has occurred, you have to ask, is it going to be resolved? Now, I believe when you resolve any kind of redlining, yes, you have to have policies, but it's still happening undercover. Now, like I said, redlining falls under the broader category of credit rationing because as African Americans, we're stereotyped of being poor, uneducated. We have no credit or bad credit. And the problem is, we as African Americans don't own anything. And when we did own something, lower class whites destroyed it. And if you look at what we're doing to each other now, we have envy and jealousy with each other. But even though I mentioned redlining and systemic racism, One thing that's missing, it's having pride in our own communities. It's having our own businesses. Most of us African Americans will never do that. Because a big part that hurts us is the envy and jealousy. And we have a lot of self-hate. And we have a crabs in a barrel mentality. So until we can take care of ourselves psychologically, and understand that racism exists, but we can beat racism, but in our mind, we're still slaves. But if we can get rid of that plantation slave thinking and learn how to work together and understand that we're all we got, the cities that we live in that were functioning, that were prosperous, can be functional again. And you also must realize who's running these cities. Black folk are running these cities. Your black pastor also comes to the city for his church service. But the leaders in a black community, they don't care about these cities. There's certain areas in every city that's going to be highlighted, and it's always the downtown section. But people don't live downtown. It's where they work and shop. But I'm going to continue more on urban decay. But I wanted to give you this detailed information on what redlining is. Because when you understand what went on with these banks and these subprime mortgages, you'll have an idea of why black people in some of these areas had houses that foreclosed and they just sat there and they became abandoned. And eventually, no one would invest in the communities because of the high crime, high out of wedlock pregnancies, the welfare state, no families, low education, and of course, high unemployment. So if you have leaders who look like you but don't care about you, because these are the ones who can get money allocated from federal and state governments, well, when you don't have any money, you don't have any city. And if you don't have a city that's functional, you're going to always end up living in the hood and living a poor life. And at the end of the day, that's a life that's not saved. You know what I mean? A life that's not saved? Because when you don't have any resources, you can't save yourself. Because there's not enough resources to go around to help everybody out. And not only will you not be able to save yourself, you're going to be looking over your shoulder because the community that you live in is unsafe. And if you don't believe me, you go to Gary, Indiana, Benton Harbor, Michigan, Flint, Michigan, Camden, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, Orange, New Jersey, Patterson, New Jersey, Baltimore, Maryland, Chicago, Illinois, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, South Bend, Indiana, Detroit, Michigan, you name it. If you go to every city, that includes St. Louis in the mix, all cities have hood, and living in a hood is not good. You don't want to live in a ghetto. You want to live in a clean neighborhood. But it takes money and investment. And it also takes trust and building. And as black people, we don't have that with each other. And that's why we're going to continue to live in the hood. Some of us get out, but most of us stay in a prison. And a prison is known as the hood. And that's my commentary for this edition of the 411 Talk Zone radio show for this evening, the first day of summer, June 21st, 2018. You can tune in to the 411 Talk Zone radio show every Saturday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. I've been doing more podcast Blog Talk Radio shows on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So if you want to call in, guest calling number is 215-383-5785. Folks, like, share, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube, the 411 Talk Zone radio show, because what I'm giving you is information that is educational from a professional and mature perspective. Of course, on my channel, I don't engage in debates, controversial issues, or emotional issues. What I do is teach. I'm a self-awareness channel. Also, the topics are very positive and realistic on my channel. This is why I don't engage in drama or unnecessary bickering, because it is counterproductive. Again, if you understand what's going on in the real world, like where you live in the cities or even some of the rural areas, and why you find abandonment in your cities, dilapidated buildings, and liquor lining, well, I've given you the information. And once you know why it occurs, you gain the knowledge. And it'll give you some motivation to build your city or leave your city. But whichever, you understand why your city is in a condition that it's in. And again, when you have knowledge, you have power. If you have a topic, a new YouTube channel, or business that you would like for me to discuss on YouTube or Blog Talk Radio, please email me at lej6521@gmail.com. And if you have a comment, please leave your comment in the comment section under the video. But make sure that your comments are pithy. No bloviating, pettifogging, or filibustering. And that's it for this video. My name is Leon Jones. Remember, always be blessed for what you have. Don't worry about what you don't have. Know that the sun always rises in the east and sets in the west. Thank you for listening to this commentary from the 411 Talk Zone radio show on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, my name is Leon Jones. You can catch my next podcast here on Blog Talk Radio on Tuesday, June 26, 2018 at 6:30 p.m. The topic, simping causes men to be thirsty. That's right. Next week's topic is simping causes men to be thirsty. Now, I may throw another podcast in over the weekend regarding urban decay. I'll see how much time I got. But until then, please be gentle and respectful to each other and have a wonderful and blessed night. God bless you.